If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's podcast, you'll hear an interview with the historian Matthew Jenkinson. Matthew is the author of a new book, Charles I's Killers in America. He spoke to our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, about the lives of the regicides Edward Whalley and William Gough, who escaped the colonies after the Civil War and the execution of the king.
Though this book looks largely at the aftermath of the lives of these two men after the death of Charles I, would you be happy to give our listeners a refresher of their role in the events leading up to the death of the king?
In essence, it's worth starting with the civil wars themselves. Both Whalley and Gough are major military figures. You've got Whalley fighting at Master Moor and Naseby. Whalley, I should say, is Oliver Cromwell's cousin. And Gough is Whalley's son-in-law. So they fight with distinction in the English civil wars. Once Charles has been defeated, Whalley himself ends up guarding Charles I at Hampton Court. And during 1647, 1648, when we have the army prayer meetings at Putney, the Putney debate, which is preceded by a Puritan prayer meeting, and in 1648 with the Windsor prayer meeting, it's William Gough who plays a major role in enthusiastically, kind of in a, following his millenarian preoccupation, and leading the denunciation of Charles I as a man of blood. And so it's for Charles, it's downhill from that point towards his execution in 1649. So in essence, from the 1640s, even before the 1640s, whenever there's action against Charles I, Whalley and Gough tend to be around and high-profile figures.
What can you tell us about their role in kind of condemning the king?
The key point is the denunciation of him as a man of blood. And they are the 4th and 14th signatories of the death warrant. So they're pretty high up. There are 59 signatories. So 4th and 14th. They're present during Charles's trial. I think one of them only misses one day. And then once the death warrant is signed, they're marked. So after Charles's execution, as with the 1640s, the period of the 1650s with the constitutional experiments, the Rump Parliament, bare bones, the rule of the major generals, the protectorate parliaments, Whalley and Gough, again, they're there. They're pretty high profile figures. They're both major generals in 1655 in the ill-fated rule of the major generals under Cromwell. Gough, there's one source that even pinpoints Gough as a potential successor as Lord Protector to Oliver Cromwell. It's not a widespread view, but there was at least one person who was thought that he might be a contender. And their prominent role in the 1650s, as well as with the regicide itself, I mean, when we get to 1660, there's almost no way they're going to be forgiven at the Restoration.
Can we talk about then that prevailing thought that Charles II sought revenge, this bloody revenge for the murder of his father, and how you perhaps challenge it in this account?
So the historiography of Charles II and the desire for revenge focuses very much on gory episodes, because gory episodes attract your attention. Things like exhuming bodies. The bodies of Cromwell, Arden and Bradshaw. When you look at the reality of the trial of the regicides, those who don't flee, those who are caught, and you look at the discussions, you look at the way that the trials proceed in 1660, and the fact that relatively few of the people who are found guilty of treason are executed. And fundamentally, I mean, again, Charles is quite savvy. The Venetian ambassador, Giaverina, even notes that on days that regicides are due to be executed, Charles removes himself from Whitehall, from anywhere near the spectacle. And that's partly to avoid any petitions, and it's partly because he doesn't want to be personally associated with this kind of bloodbath. The historiography pulls us in two directions. And one is that he's a pragmatic, cynical politician of a king. And the other is that he is this ideologically driven, you know, rabid, bloodthirsty king who's desperate for revenge for those who killed his father. And of course, the reality is somewhere down the middle. And it moves more towards the pragmatic as the early years of the Restoration proceed. And it becomes clear that the more that you revisit the good old cause, the more that you give regicides time and space to revocalise that cause, the more sympathy they're going to get, and the less likely you are to settle the nation in an effective way. The issue is that once we get into the mid 1660s, the religious politics coming much more to the fore. We have the natural disasters preoccupying king and courtiers. And suddenly catching two or three people in America goes quite far down the priority list, especially when you've got the pragmatic side of keeping your colonies stable comes into it again.
However you perceive this era of retribution, your book does focus on these two lives of Wally and Gough. They flee to America. What can you tell us about their actions and the choice of going to the colonies as well?
They didn't have to go there. They could have gone to Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands. Other regicides did. It's pretty brave to go 3,000 miles, you know, 10-week journey on the Prudent Mary. They choose to go there partly because they have a history of personal contacts, and partly because the colonies are known to be sympathetic to the good old cause, to the Cromwellian cause. And they arrive in Charlestown, travel down to Boston and Cambridge, and they're met openly, and they're met very warmly by people who know who they are. I mean, there's a question later on. People try to rewrite history and try to question whether the people like John Endicott, who's the governor of Massachusetts Bay, whether they really know who these people are. They knew who they were, and Wally and Gough are travelling quite openly. Well, you could argue that they're met openly because at the time Wally and Gough aren't fugitives, or they're not known to be fugitives. You could argue on the other side that they've turned up in Charlestown, in Boston, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. People would ask the question, why have they come now? There had already been rumours that the Cromwellian era was over, was falling back in England. So I don't believe they didn't know who these people were, and they're entertained openly. So they spend some time there, and it takes a while for any legal proclamations to come over from London. And then we get into this period when the colonial authorities have to decide whether they're going to protect Wally and Gough or not, whether they're going to support them in their travel around New England, and the extent to which they're going to implement these, you know, orders coming back from Charles I's government back in Whitehall. And so it's a pretty long and complicated story, but to cut it short, they, after a period in up in Boston and Cambridge, they travel south, they go down through Guildford, they end up in New Haven, and it's in New Haven that any attempts to capture them become most kind of pronounced. Then, and they stay in their famous cave, the Judge's Cave, which is just outside the settlement of New Haven, up in the hills. And after a period there, they end up travelling north to Hadley. They're there in the 1670s. And then to Wally dies in Hadley. And then Gough ends up travelling to Hartford. So they travel, they cover a few miles along the way. The extent to which they're being chased is open to question, and really kind of what I was trying to look at in the book. But they're on the run for 15 years, or 15 years for Wally, 19 years for Gough.
And I wondered if we could go into a little more, what was it about the colonies in New England specifically, or perhaps people there, that made it made those political or spiritual sympathies a good fit for Wally and Gough?
Well, of course, I mean, these are Puritan settlements, and Wally and Gough are Puritans. These are settlements that have little sympathy for the Stuart monarchy. If we go right back to the early 17th century settlements, these are people who are leaving England to avoid kind of Stuart-branded religious repression. Of course, they engage in their own form of repression once they get there, but they're escaping the kind of thing that the kind of repression that they would have experienced under the early Stuarts. There is also the theory, it's a very compelling theory, that these Puritans exercise a form of godly republicanism, that they are used to organising their own churches in an independent way. And it's not an enormous psychological leap to suggest that they could exercise their secular lives in an independent way, especially the case when you're 3,000 miles away from a government that's meant to be controlling you, if they have such an interest. These are also settlements that are often, obviously not always, but often founded by trading companies who are fiercely independent, jealous of their liberty, jealous of their charters that give them the freedom to trade. And they don't want any encroachment from the Restoration government. And so anything that signals that kind of encroachment becomes very serious. The most obvious example of that with Leet is the spectre of a general governor being sent over from England, a general governor of New England. And there's a warrant sent from Edward Nicholas in Whitehall, where if you read the syntax in the right way, or the way that you want to read it, in the way that Leet read it, it sounded like Edward Nicholas, who's one of Charles's secretaries of state, is addressing the present governor of New England. And of course that scares people like Leet, who don't want their proto-independence taken away by this kind of encroaching figure, a figure who comes later under James II, so it does happen and doesn't go very well. But in the 1660s, there is this fear that the Restoration government is going to have a greater interest in having a much tighter control over what the colonies are doing, partly because, of course, they've been disloyal anyway. In the 1650s, they're famously supportive, sympathetic to Cromwell. Ministers like John Cotton are preaching in defence of Cromwell, in defence of the regicide. And so, anyway, there's a Puritan colony that they're going to be sympathetic to Wally and Gough and not particularly sympathetic to Charles II.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The myths that rise up about Wally and Gough are energetic and, you know, David versus Goliath. they're adventure stories, they're fun, they're cocking a snook to the British government in the way that revolutions are done in the 1770s.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You mentioned that they weren't always treated like fugitives, or they didn't always treat themselves as fugitives. But as a historian, can you talk about the challenges of piecing together that history when inevitably the written record is going to be different if these men are kind of on the run?
Yep. Fundamentally, it's very difficult to piece together because they don't write everything down. That said, of course, Gough did keep a diary for 7 years, which is... disappeared. I mean, come back to that. There are letters that exist. There's correspondence. So Wally's sister, Jane Hook, is married to William Hook, who corresponds with John Davenport, who's in New Haven, who talks to Gough. So we get these letters going back and forth from London to New Haven. It's a challenge. They don't write everything down. We are left with the flashpoints when interesting points happen, and proclamations issued or warrants issued either from London or from the colonial authorities themselves. And again, we can question the extent to how serious those warrants are, whether they're paying lip service to things they think they're meant to be doing to keep Charles II moderately happy. But as I say, yeah, over 19 years that Gough's on the run, a lot of it you can jump for 3 or 4 or 5 years with nothing. And you know that vaguely where they are, the house they probably are in or he is in. But we get a lot of disappearing acts. And so piecing it together was tricky. But I think we got there in the end in trying to work out where they are and what they're doing at each point, and who they're talking to, and who's protecting them. As I say, you know, we end up with dozens of names coming into the story, and if you put them together and work out their connections, there's quite an elaborate web of from Boston, New Haven, Milford, Guildford, Hartford and Hadley, individuals who know each other and who are associated with one another and who are communicating about the regicides, keeping them safe. The question is, keeping them safe from whom and when?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I'd really like to ask what's known about the men who were hunting them.
Yeah, so there are flashpoints. The most famous flashpoint is in 1661, and the Massachusetts Bay authorities have decided that for whatever reason, it's probably best to at least openly withdraw their support or withdraw their protection, encourage the regicides to travel down to New Haven, which would be a much safer place. And it's at that point that we get the appointment of two kind of bounty hunters called Thomas Kelland and Thomas Kirk. One's a merchant, one's a ship's captain. And they are appointed to follow Wally and Gough south through the kind of New England wilderness down to New Haven. And we get this situation where Kelland and Kirk get quite close, but never close enough to Wally and Gough. And that's mainly because they're given the runaround by pretty savvy people like William Leap, who's deputy governor of Guildford at the time. Very sympathetic to the regicides. And does pretty much everything in his power to, and you know, within the law, to put obstacles in Kelland and Kirk's way. And I mean, this is the most kind of germane moment in the Regicide story, because that's where lots of the myths come from, because we get them being very, very close, almost catching their prey. We get stories written later that have them being quite energetically chasing them through, you know, across bridges and things. They get to New Haven. They are given the runaround. They're delayed by the New Haven authorities. And, of course, this has been plenty of time to allow Wally and Gough to flee to a place of safety out of New Haven. They have two or three very, very short-term settlements, and they end up in this cave in the hills above New Haven.
Yes, so I'd love to go back to the cave, but you mentioned there that William Leet, or people like Leet, were obviously sympathetic to the Regicide, and you investigate the timeline very thoroughly in your book, but you also went to the cave. What can you tell us about that?
So the thing about the cave is that it's been symbolic of the Regicides, and therefore symbolic of freedom, ever since they were resident there in 1661. And over the centuries, it's been a kind of a place of pilgrimage for people celebrating Republican values. You get French revolutionaries going there after the revolution. The modern history of the cave is a lot more interesting and a lot different from that kind of lauded history. I went there when I was researching the book. I was staying in Boston and Cambridge, and thought naively that I would just take a day trip, hire a car, go down with some friends, and in the same way that we go to National Trust property here, and you know, there'd be a tea shop and whatever. The first problem was that it wasn't any maps, not maps that I could find. So we rang the park ranger and found the directions. And then when we got there, of course, you know, there was no tea room, and we ended up parking the car and taking out our cameras to find that the people that go there now aren't that interested in 17th century Puritans, but it being 3 miles away from the town and with very few visitors, it's quite a good place to go if you're a couple in love. And there were two such couples when I arrived there, and they weren't that happy that we were carrying cameras.
Is there any other kind of commemoration at the spot?
Yeah, I mean, there's a plaque on one of the stones. I should say it's not really a cave. It's a series of stones, these erratics that have been deposited with ice melting in the last ice age, that they fall conveniently on one another to leave a gap that is just big enough for two people to sleep on the floor. But there is a small plaque that says, opposition to tyrants is obedience to God. And that was placed there by one of the early visitors to the cave. And it's a sentiment that's been replicated in the novels that spring up about the Regicides as well.
So your book, you know, investigates all of these flashpoints, their movements once they've gone to America. But then the second half of your book really investigates the myths that have sprung up in the following century and since. And you write that they became key figures in the birth of modern America, and they were their stories were ripe for distortion in the ideological background of the American Revolution. I wonder if you can just give us a sense of why their stories were harnessed in this way.
So when post-revolutionary America is finding its way as an independent, both politically and culturally independent nation, they need stories. Nations are built on stories, often mythological stories. Now, one of the most prominent stories of the late 17th century about their colonial history is that of Wally and Gough. I mean, it was known by, once we get into the mid-18th century, it becomes more widespread. Why does it become particularly popular amongst kind of late 18th century, early 19th century Americans? Because they're, as I say, because they are symbolic of revolution, they're symbolic of liberty. It's kind of crass to suggest that the American Revolution and the English Civil War are the same event or the same kinds of event, but there are writers that do try to do that, and they see their history as American history as being quite cyclical in that sense. But one of the reasons why the Regicides is so attractive is that they can satisfy kind of Anglophilic tastes. You know, just because there's been a revolution doesn't mean that culturally America suddenly breaks off totally from these kind of European antecedents. But they represent something that is actually quite un-English, that they are not welcome in England post-1660. And so they can have an Anglophilic taste, but not be so English that they are alienating to a post-revolutionary American audience. So they're pretty, it's a very useful case study. Also, the myths that rise up about Wally and Gough are energetic and, you know, David versus Goliath. They're adventure stories, they're fun, they're cocking a snook to the British government in the way that revolutions are done in the 1770s. And so we have the cave episode, which is perhaps, with Callum and Kirk, it's one of the most popular areas where myths develop, or stories. And then we also get the actually much more famous example of the Angel of Hadley from the mid-1670s, probably 1676, which again, it's a heroic example of a military figure appearing from nowhere in King Philip's War, when the settlement of Hadley is under attack and it looks like the inhabitants are going to be decimated by the indigenous populations who are surrounding and attacking Hadley. And this grey-bearded ancient figure appears, coordinates the defence of the settlement and disappears again after that. And we get this figure of the grey champion, this angel appearing from nowhere. And again, these are stories that are entertaining, they're fun, and they are symbolic of preserving liberty. And so Wally and Gough, and especially Gough, become kind of honorary founding fathers, kind of founding grandfathers. They're doing things that revolutionaries would like to be doing or have been doing, but 100 years beforehand. Conveniently, 100 years beforehand. And so the idea of the cyclical nature of American history comes along. And so every time you get 1776, 1876, you get people looking back to the events that have happened exactly 100 years previously. And the Angel of Hadley is, you know, one of these fantastic stories that fits very neatly into a narrative of colonists who are always jealous of their liberty and always going to protect their liberty, whether that liberty is being threatened by the indigenous population who want to take their lives, or whether it's liberty that's threatened by the British government who want to raise taxes.
Are there any particularly absurd stories that you came across with them as figures of folklore?
Well, the ones in New Haven just don't tally chronologically. As I mentioned earlier, they have, the most famous is, they have Wally and Gough hiding under the Neck Bridge outside New Haven as Callum and Kirk pass over them. It just doesn't fit because Wally and Gough had already left quite a long time before, so there would be no reason for them to pass. The most absurd has one of the regicides in Boston taking on a kind of a pseudo duel in the marketplace and fighting somebody with a mop and a piece of cheese. And it just doesn't tally, partly because it doesn't sound particularly compelling, but also the timing of that. Of that myth would be around the time that it's known that Wally and Gough are fugitives and that they're preparing on their way from Boston and Cambridge down to New Haven. And so it just doesn't ring true to me that that somebody who was going into hiding would do something so obviously public and that would attract attention from any number of people in the area. A lot of these myths, they kind of centre around kind of military-type behaviour. And that's, of course, because Wally and Gough have fought in the English Civil Wars with such distinction and because they've been major generals in the 1650s. If we look at what Wally and Gough, or especially Gough, are actually writing during the 1660s and 70s, it bears almost no relation to the kind of military activity they've been engaged in beforehand. They're very much, you know, as I put in the book, Puritans prevaricating over psalms. Mm. These are, you know, perhaps with the exception of the Angel of Hadley, which is, you know, a one-off, under quite specific and stressed circumstances, you don't get the kind of behaviour that these myths want us to believe. Why do they grow up? Well, they grow up because if we're going to have Wally and Gough as kind of proto-founding fathers, they have to be seen to be saying, doing something a lot more interesting than writing a diary about what psalms they've been thinking about that day. Mm. They've got to be, you know, militaristic and thrusting and heroic.
Someone that you explore in your book as having given Wally and Gough this extra life in the 18th century, or this new life in the 18th century, is Ezra Stiles. What can you tell us about Stiles?
So Ezra Stiles takes over from Thomas Hutchinson as the earliest historian of the regicides. Hutchinson mentions them in his History of Massachusetts Bay, but Hutchinson, being loyal to the British government, wants to portray the regicides as being kind of strangers, kind of outcasts in New England. And he wants to portray the colonies of New England as being loyal to Charles II. And therefore, you know, he glosses over New Haven and places who were overtly disloyal to Charles. Once Ezra Stiles takes on this kind of historical baton, Ezra Stiles is president of Yale. He's based in New Haven. And he's the first to write a full-length study of the regicides in America. Now, he concedes that because there's not much documentary evidence, and so people like Hutchinson are going on documentary evidence, he's got to use oral histories. Now, oral history, as we all know, is fraught with problems in that he is taking soundings from usually grandchildren or people, acquaintances of people who once knew somebody who had heard that something happened. And so Ezra Stiles writes down these, and that's where these myths come from people who are very proud of their protection of the regicides, or their family association, or their local association with protecting Wally and Gough. Stiles is also writing at a time of revolution. He's writing in the 1780s, 1790s, researching and then writing. And of course, so we're post-American Revolution, we're post-French Revolution, and we're at a time when American figures are trying to work out the most appropriate way to found this new republic, how many vestiges of monarchism to have. And so it fits perfectly for Ezra Stiles to tell the story of Wally and Gough as a story about liberty, about republicanism, proud republicanism, I think it's almost a warning about reverting too much to monarchism back again in the 1790s and the early 1800s, that baton's taken up by other writers. But Stiles is the first to portray them as kind of heralds, proto-American revolutionaries from an earlier age, and that baton is taken up by the novelists that we've already talked about.
What was it that brought you to their history? Was it their real endeavours, or was it that kind of folklore, that legacy that they have?
I came to it totally by accident, because I was working on a very different project. I was working on a project on Charles II's court culture, and as part of that, I was looking at what was happening in London in the early years of the Restoration, looking at the coronation. And it quickly became clear that you couldn't look at the coronation without looking at what else is happening on the streets of London around that time. And that's when you get the trials and executions of the regicides. While I was looking at that, I was looking at copies of Charles I's death warrant. And being a studious DPhil student at the time, I just checked that all the names were there. And of course, one of them wasn't. It was that John Dixwell's name was missing. And John Dixwell was the third regicide, who at the Restoration flees to Hanau, but ends up in New England and meets with Wally and Gough in 1665. And so, I saw that and thought, that's interesting. I wonder what happened to the regicides who went to America and shelved it for a few years while I went back to the first project. And it was one of those situations that the more I uncovered, the more I uncovered. And it was a project that kind of did, it started out as, well, what were they doing? How long were they there? Where were they staying? To actually, well, how were they received in the succeeding decades and centuries? Because, as I think the book hopefully shows, their story is as interesting for how they are perceived in the 300 years after their time in America as for their own story.
That was Matthew Jenkinson. Matthew's book, Charles I's Killers in America, is available now, published by Oxford University Press. You can find more on Civil War history and a wealth of other topics at our website, which is historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Thursday when Sam Willis will be speaking about the Battle of Trafalgar.